Scheherazade by Maurice Ravel, to words by Tristan Klingsor. The singer was Régine Crespin, and Ernest Ansommet conducted the Orchestre de la Suisse Romande, a Decca recording that's 50 years old, but still unequalled. Well, on that steamy note, we end Sunday morning for another week. Rob's back in the driving seat next Sunday, and his selection includes the Guitar Concerto by Malcolm Arnold, played by Julian Bream. 80 years old tomorrow. Many happy returns. I'll be back next month for a couple of Sundays, and in one of which I'll be featuring performances by another soon-to-be octogenarian, Dame Janet Baker, whose birthday falls on August the 21st. I'm James Jolly. Thanks for your company today, and I hope you've enjoyed my choice of music this morning. And thanks to my studio producer this week, Lyndon Jones. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3.
The 2013 BBC Proms, the first weekend, and the riot and revolution of Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring meets the dance music of the court of Louis XIV. The first period instrument performance at the BBC Proms of Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, marking the work's centenary. Music by Lully, Rameau, Delibes and Massenet also provide more than two centuries of historical context for the work that scandalised and galvanised Paris at its 1913 premiere. Sunday night at the BBC Proms from 7:30.
Now on BBC Radio 3 Private Passions. This week, Michael Barclay explores an uninhabited island with travel writer Robert McFarlane.
I'm standing on the quay at Orford in Suffolk, and the water is up, it's high tide. I'm about to take a boat trip with scholar and prize-winning travel writer Robert McFarlane. You're going to take me, Robert, to an uninhabited island to listen to your music, but why here?
Well, Orford Ness is the remotest place I know in the south of England, I think. It's not technically an island, it's a kind of untrue or false island. It's a shingle spit about 12 miles long, very dynamic coastal feature. It whips and reforms itself with the storms. A terrain as strange as any I know, very like Mars, very unearthly, just out there, just beyond the seawall. It's this great shingle spit, a mile wide, and its outermost side is a shingle desert. It is profoundly strange. We're standing amid cow parsley and whispering grass, but over there is a stripped back, storm-bashed desert, and that's where we're going.
I loved seeing some small children just now who caught some little crabs, what we used to call gillies in Norfolk, and they were racing them down the beach to the sea.
Yeah, well, this is the wonderful thing, this mysterious place which has been cordoned off by the MOD and military research for decades has this inland side which is fun and children and families and crab racing, and over there is military research, secrecy, puzzles, enigma and tempest. I've been out here many times, I'm drawn back and back to it, and it seemed like a very good place to think about a theme that runs through all of the music I've chosen, which is remoteness, landscape, the secrets that places keep and the stories they can tell us.
I've read a lot of your writing about mountains, mountain climbing, about walking across all kinds of different landscapes, and I can't help wondering whether you come back to tidal water as something very elemental.
Well, I mean, I'm drawn to rock and hard places above all, I would think, but sea has increasingly come to fascinate me, and I've been writing about it more and more recently. It's volatile, it's trackless. It terrifies me far more than mountains do. And so something about this very frontline space that we're about to go onto, where the North Sea batters at the English coast, does centralise a lot of these, to me, fascinations of risk and danger.
We're about to get on the boat, and that might be a nice moment to hear your first music, which is not actually about the sea, but is about your beloved mountains.
Well, this is Night on a Bare Mountain. It will be very familiar to many people. And I remember first listening to this when I guess I was 8 or 9. I was brought up in North Nottinghamshire, a very unmountainous landscape, green sward and arable fields. But my dreams then were all of mountains. And I remember listening to this and to In the Hall of the Mountain King by Grieg over and over again. They were part of that dreaming. And since then, I've I've spent many nights on bare mountains one way or another, in the Himalayas and the Alps and Scotland, in bothies, in snow holes, under canvas, and indeed with no shelter at all. And something about the drama of this piece, this high contrast weather drama that we get, tranquility and storm, it's all there, it's all there.
And this, of course, I mean, the music is by Mussorgsky, but it's the Rimsky-Korsakov version, which is the very famous one.
Yes. We'll be right back.
the opening of Mussorgsky's Night on a Bare Mountain, the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by René Leibovitz. Well, this is a very deserted place, and it's lonely with all of these fallen-down Ministry of Defence sheds and huts and concrete. There's even a sign here saying, keep to the paths because of unexploded ordnance. I don't think we've done private fashions in a minefield before.
Well, we've just come out here and through the pasture lands on the inside of the spit, and we flushed a merlin, it's gorse in blossom, that lovely smell of coconut on the breeze. And then we crossed the Bailey Bridge into this extraterrestrial world of desert and moonscape and crater and abandoned buildings, and it has such an atmosphere to it of melancholy, dilapidation and exposure, I suppose.
So what was it used for then?
Well, it's had a long history, almost a century of military use from the First World War. Royal Flying Corps, ballistics testing through to nuclear weaponry stress testing, which took place in the so-called pagodas, which we can see to our south. Very distinctive structures. Now herring gulls core and breed on the summits of those buildings, and nature is really reclaiming this place.
So whatever man manages to do to landscapes, sooner or later nature will take it back into its own.
Given time, of which the earth has an abundance.
Where did this love of wild places come from for you, do you think, Robert McFarlane?
Well, I was lucky enough to have a wonderful childhood with parents who were full of adventure and travel, and they took me to island, coast, glen, and above all, mountains. And so it's from them that I have it.
And don't you love the way that nature even manages to provide us with a kind of music out here? Sometimes you'll catch the wind go through the wires or the metal, which gives a kind of eerie sound. And, of course, this is the wind itself.
Well, I happen to know, because I came out here with a wonderful double bassist, that one of the buildings over there resonates to the note of D in a certain wind. So he has tuned this place, and this place tunes the people that come to it as well.
The next piece of music you unearth for us comes from an even more remote place, doesn't it?
Yes. This is a recording made in the 1950s, made on a hand tape recorder, and you need to imagine it being made 40 miles out into the North Atlantic on an island. It barely deserves the name of island, a rock that sticks up a skerry called Sulaskia, north of the northernmost point of the Outer Hebrides. And it is as far out into the Atlantic as its more famous sibling, St Kilda, is, 40 miles west into the Atlantic. And on that island every summer, the men of Ness travel, and they travel to cull the gannet chicks that nest there. They've done this for centuries. And they sing while they're out there. They sing songs of devotion. And what you're about to hear are the reading and the prayer led by the head of the group of men, hunched in a stone bothy, dressed in tweed and gansy, with a peat fire at their centre. And the men are singing their songs of devotion and of prayer and, I suppose, of protection in this incredibly remote place. And you'll hear the men themselves then come in and sing the psalms. And to me, it vibrates through my whole body as one of the most affecting pieces of sound I've ever heard, I think. Well, I mean, just listening to that out here, I can feel that telltale tingle down the spine. It's incredibly moving to listen to anywhere, but especially out in a wind-scoured place like this. I came to know this recording through a wonderful Lewisman called Finlay MacLeod. I was out there travelling. I've known him for years now. I walked across the Outer Hebrides from his house down into Harris, and I've sailed the waters off there, including a voyage up to Sulaskir in a big old open boat with a wonderful sailor and storyteller called Ian Stephen. And so having been out to the Gannet Island and knowing quite how remote and fierce a place it is, puts it in context for me.
It reminds me of that wonderful congregational singing from that part of the world.
Yes.
And it has a kind of almost contemporary music-like feel because they all do the intonation in a kind of, oh, but they all did a slightly different speed. So you get this quite extraordinary sound. It's very beautiful and very haunting.
And it is being sung for no audience other than the men themselves and, of course, God. It so happened that a man was there with a tape recorder in the 1950s and so preserved that for 60-odd years on. But really, it was for the sake of the song and faith and the place.
A recording made 40 miles out in the Atlantic. Gaelic psalms sung by Hebridean islanders. Robert McFarlane, in your books, you've talked about pretty near encounters with death on mountains. I remember one where a whole load of rocks came flying down towards you and you were convinced that one of them was going to get you. One bounced just at the last moment, in fact. Does music come into your mind around those kind of occasions? Do you sing afterwards? Do you dance afterwards with joy?
Well, nothing comes into your mind at moments of real fear. That's one of the things fear does, is obliterate thought, really. But I do remember once getting into real trouble on a Scottish mountain, and then it was on steep ground, and we retreated eventually, got back to safe ground, and I just lay down flat because I could, because the ground was suddenly horizontal, and then a Blondie song came into my head, and I remember belting that out with joy, joy and relief.
You have a family, three children, I think.
I do.
Do you ever think about what you're possibly endangering, as it were, in terms of them and you taking on these dangerous trips?
Well, to me, and I think to many people, I mean, I'm not a great mountaineer. I'm by no means a cutting-edge climber. The notion is ludicrous, but. And actually, mountains are very safe places if you know what you're doing up there. I'm not a fan of risk. Fear is an unpleasant feeling. We all know that. I am an addict of mountains and wild places more generally. But now it is more about thought, about beauty, about reflection, the availability of certain kinds of thinking that can only happen in those places. And risk is really way down the list of interests now.
And I suppose, actually, all of us that like pushing the boundaries of exploring, you know, whether we're scuba diving on the Barrier Reef or whether we're skiing, there's always an element of risk attached.
There's an element of risk fishing or horse riding, which have, high incidence of accidents, but one wouldn't necessarily think of a gymkhana as a risky situation, like, as one would a mountain. So it's risk perception's a complicated business.
Actually, come to think of it, driving a car is pretty dangerous. And the next music, I think, is what you listen to when you are in a car.
Oh, yes. Well, this is wonderful. To me, this rondo from Brahms' Piano Quartet is just so full of energy and verve and brio. And to me, it is about transit. It is about adventure to come. It is about restless forward motion, this unstoppable kinesis. And my heart starts leaping in time to the bows, and I've listened to it so many times on the way to landscapes that I love.
Thank you. Rondo from the Brahms Piano Quartet, Opus 25, number 1 in G minor, played by Murray Pariah and members of the Amadeus Quartet.
Why don't we go up to the top of this building, which is called the Bombalistics Building, because it was where they would view the fall of armaments from the planes, and see what we can see from its summit. That's an angry North Sea. Well, up here we're at about, I guess, 20 feet up in this very lateral landscape, and we start to see a little bit of what the birds see as they come over in their tens of thousands during migration seasons particularly, but throughout the year.
And you can see these craters here too, which have given various forms of wildlife a fresh start in a strange way.
They have, and I mean, often I've seen, I mean, hares are out here, and they tend to take shelter in there, and sometimes you'll pass and a hare will explode out of this bomb crater and then dash off, spitting shingle from its back feet as it goes. It has its own soundscape, this landscape, as any place does, but this one is perhaps more haunting than most. You can hear an oyster catcher in the background there. The gulls are coming over. There's a strange silence, but then it gets shot through by these high keening noises that the wind makes through the structures that survive, and then of course the bird song and the bird calls as they come over. We can hear gulls in the background, big colony of gulls here, and of course the endless kind of white noise of the sea.
Just looking down here, there's a path that is a safe path because it's been cleared, but it for all the world looks to me like one of Richard Long's paths, you know, that he makes in the sand.
Well, Long's most famous one is a line made by walking, but I know exactly the desert works you mean, and the path we're looking down on through the shingle has been marked out with a kind of rust red dye that shows where you can safely walk. Exactly, and this strange relationship between human mark making in the landscape in the form of paths and tracks and artwork and artifact, and this lovely song that's coming. We're starting to hear these high notes caused by the wind. I don't know if they're audible, but it adds to the hauntingness of this place.
The rain's really quite heavy now. Let's get under shelter. You've often talked and written, Robert, when you're in a landscape like this, you have a sensation of walking with ghosts, and I think one ghost in particular.
Well, Edward Thomas, the poet and essayist and natural historian who died in the First World War, has been a very important figure to me for years now, and I've written a lot about him, particularly in the old ways. And that sense of companions on the path, even if they're no longer living, is very strong in his work and fascinated me. The next piece I thought we could listen to is Berceuse by Chopin. And we know that Thomas listened to this out in his billet just behind the front lines at Arras in the spring of late winter of 1917. He was out there for 10 weeks. He kept an extraordinary war diary that was very alert to the birdsong, but also to the human music that was playing in those billets. An officer had brought a gramophone, and he would write down the songs the men sung and the tunes the gramophone played. So when we listen to this incredibly fragile, beautiful tune, in the context of destruction, we need to think of it drifting through these big empty houses where Thomas was living and working, and in the weeks leading up to his death.
It's a sort of lullaby, and I suppose you could say it's his lullaby.
It is. One of the last poems he wrote before embarkation was called Lights Out and was about falling to sleep. And this is the lullaby which really led up to his death.
Thank you.
Well, while we were listening to the Champin, the Berceuse, played by Vladimir Ashkenazy, we've had to move underneath the ballistics building, the observation building, because the rain started to come down. But as we came through the door, two terns, I think they were, came at us in such a beautifully kind of delicate scissored flight that they almost seemed to be dancing to the music.
It was a wonderful moment, yeah, just beating up wind, such delicate birds.
And does birdsong itself affect you very deeply?
Well, I mean, I love it as everyone does, as a kind of incidental daily jubilation, as a sense of nature's energy and riot and joy, even though it's not really those things. But yes, wonderful. And Thomas heard it. He listened to it. It was his consolation in the trenches. He listened to the chink of chaffinches and the twang of partridges, as well as the rickle of the machine guns and the crash of the big artillery pieces.
And that's a very appropriate moment to turn to the next piece, because it too was inspired by birdsong, as was a huge amount of Messiaen's music, of course. But this also has a wartime association, but the Second World War, doesn't it?
Yeah, we've moved forward to the Second World War. Messiaen has been interned in a prison camp, and he begins work on the Quartet for the End of Time, which I listened to again and again when I was a graduate student in Oxford, and I see now convenes all of my lifelong interests, really, in creativity in a context of confinement and conflict. And he began writing, in this case, Abîme des Oiseaux is the movement we're going to listen to, in which he pits the abîme, the abyss, against the oiseau, the bird song, which is so kind of cheery and impious when it comes. It's this wonderful affirmation of life and jubilation and nature.
And it was, in fact, a triumph of improvisatory skill, really, to put these instruments together, because there wasn't a 100% working instrument available. They had to sort of mend things with whatever sort of materials they could find, and in a wonderful way found musicians to play the instruments. So out of the most appalling circumstances, they created this music, which has, as you say, such a life-affirming quality to it.
Thank you. I just loved hearing that again out here today in the rain and the storm on Orford Ness. And listening to it, I heard again the really abyssal sense that threatens the birdsong in the opening section. And then comes that amazing change and that cheery, impious piping that pops up. And it's wonderful, repudiation.
The clarinetist Claude Desumont in Messiaen's Abîme des Oiseaux from his quartet for the End of Time. You were saying how the bleakness of this place mirrors in many ways that music. And why do we find bleakness beautiful, do you think? Do we find it cathartic in the way we find sad music cathartic?
It's a very, very good question. It strips us back. Bleak comes from the Norse word blika, meaning bone, and there is that sense of death and menace deep in it, which, although I am constitutionally a very cheery person, I know holds a great fascination for me, and this is why I keep returning to writers and artists who've worked in extremis and tackled great challenges in landscape.
Keep to the path.
These egrets keep, I love these little egrets that keep lifting off, and they are they're the whitest of birds. They absolutely gleam, burn on the eye when they come up, much whiter than gulls. Oh, there goes a hare. Can you see it just loping off down in that dip there? Those big shunting hind hindquarters. I'm glad we've seen a hare.
Well, we've finally reached the far side of the island by the lighthouse and the ocean itself, rather than the river. And again, a sense of desolation here, because there's this broken down house and shed just to the right, which could come straight out of Psycho, really. I expect to see Anthony Perkins walking out of the door.
I always love reaching this point, and you can just start to hear the sea churn. And the North Sea, the big waves pick up the shingle, and you can see the shingle in the belly of the waves as they rise and fall.
Well, we've had to take refuge from the elements again, Robert McFarlane, but there's one thing I really can't resist asking you about, especially since we're by the sea, and that is, are you about to take a dip?
Well, I have swum off the point of the Ness, which is just over there. There, it was a hot day, but the tide was fierce and the shingle shelved steeply. So I haven't been back in since. So no, you're safe and there's no obligatory swimming for
you. But you know why I'm asking you, don't you? Because you're president of the Outdoor Swimming Society.
Well, I think I'm patron, which doesn't necessarily commit me to dips at all times. But no, I love swimming. I love swimming outdoors, though. My body rebels more and more as I get older and older. But no, swimming in seas and rivers and lochs and creeks, beautiful.
Well, as it happens, you're going to be saved, because I think the boat will be arriving to take us back to the village of Orford and possibly the pub. And to accompany us, perhaps, a drinking song.
Ah, yes. Well, this is... I'm fortunate enough to have married at a very young age a wonderful person, Julia, my wife, who is a sinologist. She's a classical and contemporary Chinese specialist, and she introduced me to the Shan Shui tradition, the rivers and mountains tradition of classical Chinese poetry. And one of the great stars of that tradition is the Tang poet Li Bo, Li Bai. And he was a wandering scholar, a drinker, a lover of mountains, bamboo, wildness, all the things that have been running through what we've been talking about. And Mahler encountered a German translation of a French version of this 8th century poem, and it became one of his Lied von der Erde. And it's a drinking song, it's two fingers in the face of death, it's full of vigour and sadness and melancholy and energy and wine, and I love it.
Well, thank you very much, Robert McFarlane. I see Duncan, our trusty guide, is about to rescue us from the island. It's been a great pleasure.
And a great pleasure for me too out here on Orford Ness.
If life is a dream, why all this work and worry? I drink all day till I can drink no more, then I roll home and sleep.
zwitschert. Ja, ja. Der Lenz. Der Lenz ist da, sei kommen über Nacht. Aus tiefstem Schauer lauscht ich auf. Der Vogel singt und lacht. Und lacht. Ich fülle mir den Becher neu und leer ihn bis zum Grund und singe bis der Mond erglänzt am schwarzen Firmament. Und wenn ich nicht mehr singen kann, so schlaf ich wieder ein. Was geht mich denn der Frühling an? Lass mich betrunken sein.
Mahler's drinking song from Das Lied von der Erde, Der Trunkene in Frühling, with Fritz Wunderlich singing and Otto Klemperer conducting the Philharmonia Orchestra. Michael Barclay was talking to Robert McFarlane. All the details of today's music can be found on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website, where you can also download the programme and find information about how to visit Orford Ness. The producer was Elizabeth Burke, and the series is a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. Next week, Michael Barclay's guest will be the Chief Rabbi, Jonathan Sacks. This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. The time now is 1 o'clock, and here's the BBC News. I'm Jill Anderson. Two 15-year-old girls have been arrested on suspicion of manslaughter after a firefighter was killed tackling a blaze in Manchester last night. Stephen Hunt was among 60 crew called to the fire in the storeroom of Paul's Hair World in Oldham Street. Mr. Hunt was 38 and had two children. Senior colleagues said it appeared he'd been overcome by sudden and intense heat. Seven police officers were hurt in Belfast last night during a second night of rioting by loyalists. Officers were attacked with petrol bombs, fireworks and stones. 32 officers were injured on Friday night. The father of an unarmed black teenager who was shot dead in Florida by a Neighbourhood Watch volunteer has said he's heartbroken that his son's killer has been cleared. George Zimmerman, who's 29, shot 17-year-old Trayvon Martin during a confrontation in a gated community in February last year. He'd argued that he'd acted in self-defence. A BBC Panorama investigation suggests that 50 soldiers and veterans took their own lives last year, compared with 44 troops who were killed in Afghanistan. The Ministry of Defence says suicide among members of the armed forces is extremely rare, and the rates are lower than among civilians. Police in Canada say they're not treating as suspicious the death of one of the stars of the television series Glee. Corey Monteith, who was 31, played Finn Hudson in the show about an American high school choir. He was found dead in a hotel room in Vancouver. A woman has been killed while walking her dog in Prudhoe in Northumberland. The dog also died. Police are appealing for the driver of the car to come forward. Placido Domingo has left hospital in Madrid after spending 5 days being treated for a blood clot in his lung. The tenor's son, Alvaro Domingo, said he expected his father to spend 3 weeks recuperating and that he was not considering retiring. The 72-year-old singer cancelled 6 appearances in Madrid because of his treatment. It's emerged that the Harry Potter author, J.K. Rowling, has secretly written a crime novel under another name. The Sunday Times reported that the writer won plaudits for The Cuckoo's Calling, about a war veteran-turned-private investigator. Rowling used the pseudonym Robert Galbraith for the book, which was published in April. Kate Mills, a fiction editor at another publisher, Orion Books, has admitted on Twitter that she turned down the book. She called for others to confess if they'd done the same. A bus company has been accused of losing its way with words when advertising for a passenger assistant. Go Ahead London advertised for a good face-to-face communicator who had customer-facing experience and a natural flair for going the extra mile. The Plain English campaign said an advertisement for a bus conductor would have been a better option. And the weather. It's continuing dry, warm and very sunny across England and Wales. It's hot in the south, where temperatures could reach 30 Celsius, but it's cooler in northern areas, with rain or drizzle in northern Scotland. Temperatures are 23 Celsius in Manchester, 20 in Edinburgh, 19 in Belfast and 26 in London. And that's the BBC News and weather. It's coming up to 4 minutes past one. And now, with more highlights from this year's York Early Music Festival, here's Catherine Bott with the Early Music Show.
Hello and welcome to the second of our programmes marking the 300th anniversary of the death of the composer and virtuoso violinist Arcangelo Corelli. Yesterday we heard music from the composers from whom he learned his art and with whom he worked in Rome. Today we're going to hear two of his finest trio sonatas, played by La Risonanza, as part of their concert in the 2013 York Early Music Festival. There's more than that to enjoy, but let's begin right away with Corelli's captivating trio sonata in A major, opus 3, number 12, in 9 concise movements.